This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Join me, please, in an attitude of prayer. Mystery of many names and mystery beyond all naming. We come here this morning with smiles on our faces. If you're not smiling, then at least grin or place your tongue firmly in your cheek. The world is a serious place. We know this. People get blown to bits in it every day. Children are molested. Women are beaten. Soldiers die horrible deaths or they survive with terrible life-altering wounds. Lovers are betrayed, dogs are run over, cats are drowned, and the trash is not taken out. And no, we are not equating any of these actions with the others. We know violence is the foundation of cultures worldwide, but what is the point of dwelling on simply the negative? There is a balance that's struck in the body between sodium and potassium, and without that balance, our electrolytes, made up of positive and negative charges, would go out of whack, and we would die. So admitting the terrible, we pass on today to dwell on other matters. Or maybe we simply wish to nod in the direction of the world's failings, if the negatives of life can be said to be failings, and look upon the jewels that sparkle on the river as the sun reflects off its surface. Sure, we know they're not really jewels, but that doesn't stop our imaginations from seeing something where it really doesn't exist and making up a story about it. Tell a child that those sparkling jewels on the river don't exist. Go ahead, explain about the sun's rays and the reflective properties of water. The only reaction you'll get from a child is the look of boredom as they realize you're trying to kill their imagination. Besides, everything human made was once something simply imagined. Sure, imaginings are nothing more than mental notions, creations, or conceptions of a poetic mind. But wasn't it Ralph Waldo Emerson in his Harvard Divinity School address who imagined a time that would come when miracles of the Bible would be replaced by the miracles of green meadows and falling rain? Wasn't it the Plains Indians who imagined that their ghost dancing would bring back the buffalo and make the white man disappear? Wasn't it the imagining of Holocaust survivors making plans for a seemingly non-existent future that kept them alive when others around them were dropping like flies? Wasn't it the imaginings of the boy Sam Clemens while rafting on the mighty Mississippi that gave birth to the man Mark Twain? Wasn't the imaginings of Jan Hus as he passed the cup of the Eucharist over the railing to the common people that led to the flaming chalice of this denomination? Wasn't it the imaginings of a poor Galilean that all God's children could live in peace that created a world religion that went on to pervert that poor Galilean's message to the point of total non-recognition? Isn't it our own imaginings that someday our lives will fall in place, that keeps us going, supplies us with the energy that pushes our lives forward in spite of the entropy that leads us toward the grave? This morning, we're here to celebrate imagination, story, and the inherent silliness of all sentient beings. We pray this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen. This is the second in a trilogy of sermons about the baptism of Jesus. If you were here 2 months ago, you heard John the Baptist's viewpoint. Today I'm giving the viewpoint of the River Jordan. Israel's mighty Mississippi. They put the I in the bulletin, but it shouldn't have been there. And luckily, the way things worked out, since I was bumped from the pulpit last month by a guest speaker, I'll be able to preach the third and final sermon on April Fool's Day, and it's the baptism of Jesus as seen from the biggest fool of all, Jesus. The rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated. So begins Hal Holbrook's one-man show concerning the life of Mark Twain. Where would Samuel Clemens have been without the Mississippi River? The young writer knew the lesson of the prophet who was not accepted in his own homeland, so he dropped the name, the tag that had followed him thus far in his life, and took another. There on the mighty Mississippi, Clemens first heard the call of the boatswain as he swung the leaded line that gave safety and security to riverboat captains as they navigated a river whose bottom changed daily. Without the mighty Mississippi, Twain would have been traveling by stagecoach, wagon train, cattle drive, railroad, or possibly even on foot. And what derring-do name would he have sifted from those experiences? He could have called himself Westward Ho, but the later generations of freed slaves would have had a field day with that one. He might have gone under the nom de plume G. Haw, or maybe All Aboard! Now that would have gotten everybody on the same track. The point is, who's to say whether Samuel Clemens would have made it without the river, that old man river? It's a treat to beat your feet on the Mississippi Mud River, that artery of America that carried everything that was made in the north to the south and everything that was grown in the south to the north. The equalizer of society where whale-heeled gentlemen's loose ladies and cards combined to make fortunes for some and some paupers forever. I am the River Jordan. I know. It inspires nothing nowadays. There was a time when the simple pronouncement, I am the River Jordan, would have sent a panic chill of pride and purpose through the listening world. But the world was smaller then. In that part of the now spacious world where I still flow, I still hold sway. There are those who remember, those who kowtow, those who covet, those who wail as they are immersed beneath my murky waters. Yes, I make a difference to some, and I'm grateful for the work, but for the world at large, the movers, the shakers, the prophets, the healers, the wise men, the fools, their lives still fabric the world, but their connection to me has all but ceased. In the interest of world economy, the world is being destroyed. Global warming, no longer the hex of Greenpeace, but the front page New York Times reality. Pollution, acid rain, raw sewage, and neglect have created a disconnect between those who are two-thirds water, but no longer consider the source, and that disconnect is about to take revenge. Now you say you love me, and if it's true, well, you can cry me a river, cry me a river, I cried a river over you. You may think my time has come and gone, and that being a river, I'm nothing more than a way through which water passes, but I could say the same about you. Rather, I will tell you of my life, what I've seen, those that I've touched, blessed, baptized. And when I'm through, you can babble on like that Greek idiot Heraclides and swear you've never stepped in the same stream twice, but you'll still be all wet. Do you understand that my touch can heal? My touch can aid armies. My touch can bring the dove of God descending up down upon one of the sons of God. My touch can confer the crown of eternity. Not knowing this, you turn aside, uninterested. But who am I to boast? I'm just babbling on here, running on, as it were, seeking my own level. So much water under the bridge, a stream of consciousness, if you will. They say there are no more great ones. They say that those who rule now, both politically and economically, are but the midget children of giants. In the beginning, In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless, and empty darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Imagine, if you can, maybe you felt this way in a dream, or maybe someone you really love delivered this feeling to you with the intimate touch of their body on your body. Or maybe you just have a good imagination, but think of it. The Spirit of God hovering over you, close as a breath, caressing the wetness of oblivion. Oh, yes, the darkness was over the face of the deep. Imagine you and God like this. I know, I'm in a Unitarian Universalist church. Okay. So most of you could care less whether you and God are like this. Yeah, I get it. There's a tendency among liberal religionists to take those two fingers and have the index finger bow to the center. But you've forgotten something when you raise those contorted fingers to God. You have forgotten that an index is something that serves to guide, point out, or otherwise facilitate reference. When you flip off God, all you're really doing is bowing to the center. And you call yourself leftists, liberals. The point is, God exists whether you like it or not. If you have the word in your vocabulary, if you know what the word God means, then the existence of God cannot be denied. To say that you don't believe in God, well, that's tantamount to saying that you don't believe in words, and you do believe in words. Even atheists define themselves as being without God. You may not have creeds, at least not ones that they've written down and repeat religiously, excuse the pun, but you do have patterns of thinking, and those patterns are represented in catchphrases, the seven principles, or as some have called them in this church, the seven banalities. And those phrases repeated often enough become a liturgy, ceremonial rites that invoke, remember, give thanks, bless, praise, and present offerings. Within traditional liturgy, these rites center on God. If not God, then what do these rites center on in this church? In the 19th century, one John William McGarvey preached a sermon entitled The River Jordan. In that sermon, he noted several wonderful things about me that makes me stand head and shoulders, or should I say, headwaters and banks, above all other rivers in the world. And if you were thinking this man was exaggerating, then I would draw your attention to what one of his biographers wrote. McGarvey relies almost exclusively on facts and has very little imagination. I, the River Jordan, am mentioned approximately 175 times in the Old Testament and 15 times in the New Testament. Can you see a pattern there? Interest in me waned as time went by. For example, how many of you can tell me which direction I flow? Where do I begin? Where do I end? I began in the heights of Mount Hermon, north of Galilee, and from multiple sources I flow south, just like the Mississippi, to Lake Huleh. From there I flow into the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus is reported to have preached calm waters and walked on my waters. From the Sea of Galilee, I descend 65 miles to the Dead Sea, so called because it has no outlet. From my beginnings into the north and the heights of Mount Hermon to my terminus in the deep, deep Dead Sea, I drop 2,380 feet and have a winding course of some 200 miles, which is actually twice the distance between Mount Hermon and the Dead Sea. Unlike every other river in the world, the majority of my navigation lies below sea level and ends in a body of water, the Dead Sea, which is the lowest lying body of water other than the oceans on the face of the earth. There are four miracles associated with my waters, which I'd like to speak about today. Don't flinch when I say the word miracles. Miracles don't have to be acts of God. They can also represent events or circumstances that give one a sense of admiring awe, or maybe even they're a literary device. The first incident is found in the book of 2 Kings. A man named Naaman, a captain of the Syrian guard and a mighty warrior who had fought and won many battles, was also, unfortunately, a leper. Now, a young girl in Naaman's household who was an Israelite slave, she told him about a prophet Elijah who could cure Naaman of his leprosy. So Naaman went to Samaria and asked to be cured of his leprosy, but Elijah wouldn't even come from his house. He sent a servant to tell Naaman to go bathe in my waters. Naaman got angry when he heard this because there were plenty of nice rivers in Syria where he might have bathed. And besides, he wanted to see this prophet, even if the prophet couldn't cure him. Naaman's own servants finally convinced him, "Hey, we're in Samaria, the River Jordan's there, why don't you take a bath?" So Naaman dipped himself 7 times into my waters, and when he emerged, his flesh was like the flesh of a newborn babe. The second incident concerns my holy waters. It was recorded in the book of Joshua. After Moses had wandered with the people of Israel for 40 years, every woman knows why Moses wandered for 40 years, right? He wouldn't stop and ask directions. Moses died before he could cross over to the promised land, so Joshua was chosen to lead the people across the Jordan River into the land of milk and honey. But it was harvest time, and the river was swollen, and they couldn't get across. So in a dream, Joshua was told to take the Ark of the Covenant down to the banks of the Jordan. And once they stepped in, miraculously, the river dried up. They were able to cross on dry land into the land of milk and honey. The fourth incident that happened of great spiritual significance was, of course, Jesus' baptism in my holy waters. I've understood that you've heard from John, the one they call the Baptist. A word about John. He not only baptized his followers in my water, but he also bathed there, drank my water, and when there was a crowd for baptisms and he couldn't take a break, he relieved himself in those selfsame waters. He was not a man of clean habits, but what can you expect from a man who insults his visitors by screaming, "You brood of vipers, who warned you of the wrath to come?" And also ate bugs and stole honey from bees. There's a great deal written about Jesus' baptism. It's been reported that a dove descended from heaven and landed on his head. It's been reported that John declared that this is the one he'd been waiting on, the one he couldn't even tie the sandal of. It's been reported that the heavens opened and the very voice of God spoke, saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." I can't verify any of these happenings because I'm just a river, just passing through, hurrying on my way. And besides, you know the way things sound to you underwater? That's the way things sound to me above water. What I can tell you is that when John baptized Jesus, he held him under the water for an ungodly length of time. To the eyes of the world, it may have looked like a baptism, but to me, it looked like John was trying to drown Jesus. That would have made sense. Jesus was the new prophet, the new kid on the block. John's popularity was waning. Surely he knew his disciples would leave him and go to the Nazarene. Why do you think Jesus ran off into the desert after he was baptized? He wanted to get as far away from water as he possibly could. Now, I wish to comment on all those extraordinary things that have been recorded. First of all, those who do not understand story have difficulty with elements of story. Mark Twain rightfully said, "Never mess up a good story by sticking to the facts." Stories are not about facts. Stories are about the weaving of meaning into our life. Stories take what happened and ask, "What if?" Besides, as has been pointed out time and again, even when there are eyewitnesses, their accounts of what happened are varied to the point of seeming to be about entirely different events. This psychological effect is known by the name the Rashomon effect. This psychological effect is named after the first Japanese film to bring Akira Kurosawa to the attention of the viewing public in this country in 1950. The film Rashomon appeared. 1951, it was given the Academy Award for the best foreign language film. Rashomon presents a morally complex, multifaceted story in which different characters tell their versions of the same factual events. And although each sounds plausible and possible, none are the definitive take on what happened that afternoon in a grove of trees when a samurai and his new wife are accosted by a bandit and the entire affair is witnessed by a woodcutter who is hiding behind a tree. Now, some of you may wonder how I, the River Jordan, know about Akira Kurosawa, so I will explain. He was known as Emperor for his dictatorial directing style. At one point while directing a film, he demanded that a stream that was to be in a shot, He said that he wanted that stream redirected to flow in the opposite direction. And so it was. In the process of telling a visual story, Kurosawa thought the story would best be told if nature were reversed. And for the story he was telling, it was reversed. And you say you don't believe in miracles. Things happen in this world, and it's up to us to make sense of them. Meaning is the function of storytelling. For the culture and the time of Naaman the Syrian, it was important for me, River Jordan, in Israel, to be a place where everyone could be blessed, especially non-Israelites. When Joshua and the Israelites entered the Promised Land, that so-called Promised Land belonged to other peoples from other cultures. The Israelites supposedly murdered those people and took their lands. It was important for that particular Israelite culture to know that God was on their side, and it was God's will, not their avarice, which was the cause of those supposed genocides. Truth is, they found now that they probably intermarried and told these genocidal stories to pretend ethnic purity. Hence, the story is told that God dried up the River Jordan so the Battle of Jericho could begin. Sometimes people talk about the baptism of Jesus, and what of that? I played such an important part in the story of Israel that for a prophet to be properly introduced, that prophet must come to terms with my holy waters. Besides, Jesus was to be the new Moses, and Moses had water miracles, so Jesus had to have bigger, better water miracles. Moses parted the waters, Jesus walked on the waters. Did he really walk on water? Was it simply a metaphor of power explained in hyperbole? I think you know the answer. And do rivers talk? Can the River Jordan preach? I suggest the next time you're near a body of moving water, sit facing the water and sit still for quite a while. Listen long and hard. You'll hear the whispers, the overtones, the shoutings, the murmurs of the stream that you are making conscious. Listen carefully, for it's up to you to tell what the story of your life is disclosing.